Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton. This week, we're joined by Ned Batchelder. So, Ned, welcome to the show. So we're going to talk a lot about testing, but also your career in Python and Django coverage and all sorts of things. So really happy you could come on.
Someone
we've wanted to have on for a long time now. So thank you for making the time.
Sure. I think we've been exchanging emails about this possibility for a while.
I think from the beginning. I mean, the short list I had when we started this was you were on it. So
nice. Wow. I'm honored to be early on the list and late on the recording.
You'll notice how practiced we are now, all of that.
That's right. It's very smooth.
Yes. So you are, as a brief intro, so you don't have to say it yourself, you're a pillar of the Boston Python community. You run coverage.py. You've given lots of talks at PyCons here. You've been most recently at edX. I think most people in the Boston Python community know who you are, and many of the people at PyCons know who you are. But for those listening who perhaps don't, how do you describe yourself these days in terms of your background in the community?
Yeah, that's a good question. I often say I'm deeply embedded in the Python community. You touched on Boston Python, so I'm here in Boston, Will, as you are, and or at least last I heard, who knows what has happened in the 18 months of the lockdown. People seem to move all over the place, but... so I've been organizing the Boston Python user group for over a decade, I guess now. You mentioned PyCon. I have done a lot of PyCon talks, but with the pandemic and a few missed PyCons, it's actually been a while since I've been to a PyCon, and I haven't done any of the virtual PyCons, so I need to get back into that. But I have been maintaining coverage.py for a very long time. And as well as some other much less interesting side projects. And I work at edX as a day job, which is open source project built on Django. And I work on the open source team at edX. So my whole life is open source Python, pretty much.
So you, I think to be more specific, we both live in Brookline, because I saw your mapping project. And I thought I saw you and your son, like, 2 years ago walking along the riverway, but I didn't want to interrupt you. And you have this very cool mapping project I was looking at on your site, which we'll have a link to. And so I think I have a pretty good idea where you live, but I live in Brookline as well.
That's right. During the pandemic, my exercise of choice has been walking, because it keeps me apart from people and I can do it from home. And my son was at home with me and he needed to walk too. And to keep it interesting, I've been trying to walk on new streets every time. And I've done now, I think, 302 walks from the house to the house. And only two of them have missed getting any new streets. So it's been a fun, nerdy way to get exercise.
So this is reminiscent of Kant's Seven Bridges of Königsberg problem.
Right? But the topology is much, much worse. and we don't have time to get into all of the nerdy details that go through my head when planning walks and kicking myself for having missed a street I could have walked on and all of that stuff.
Right. Okay. And you put it on, I saw an image go past this week, I think. I didn't know about this project. Yeah. And then you've blogged about it on your site.
That's right. There have been three blog posts technically about it so far. But yeah, when I completed my 300th walk, I did another kind of visualization about how hard it is to get to new streets on walks 201 through 300, because you have to walk over all of the old streets you've already walked on to get to the new streets, and et cetera, et cetera.
And do you end up going ever further from home? Because,
yes, both because I'm getting more fit, so I can do a 6.5 mile walk and not collapse. But also, if I want to get to a new street, I have to walk farther, because I've already walked on all the streets within the 5 mile radius. So, or the 2.5 mile radius, I guess. It's been a lot of fun.
You mentioned it keeps you away from people. Would you say that's part of a programmer personality type thing there?
It sits well with my personality. I don't mind the social distancing.
Well, that's a beautiful thing to do during COVID. I'm jealous. I was stuck here with an infant the whole time.
That's right. And I've walked on streets during these walks that are within 50 yards of my house that I never had a reason to visit before. So it is eye-opening.
Well, that's great. So Python and Django. Maybe yep. I could just ask. So you have a long history with Django. I think you said I've seen you say back to 2006. I'm curious if you could yep. talk about that and how you've seen the project develop since that's pretty yeah. early.
That is early. So actually, my earliest touch point with Django was actually part of Boston Python. So in I think November of 2005, Boston Python, as one of their events, said, "Hey, let's do sort of a shootout of some web frameworks," and different people volunteered for different frameworks. I actually got Turbo Gears as the thing to try out, and someone else got this other thing, that new thing called Django, to try out. And we built some app. We chose an app, and we each built the same app and compared. But shortly after that, in January of 2006, I actually got a new job working for a startup called Tableau, T-A-B-B-L-O, not the database.
Not the billion-dollar one.
Not the billion-dollar database tool, the photo sharing and storytelling website that was eventually purchased and then disappeared by Hewlett-Packard. But that was all built in Django and Python. And the reason I got the job is that the founder of the company had asked around in Boston, like, how can I find some Python expertise? And that eventually led him to me, and we had a coffee, and, you know, the rest is history. And that was on Django 0.91 in 2006. And actually, my first week on the job, I had given 3 weeks notice at the old job instead of 2 weeks. And so through bad planning, my first week on the job was a week that my boss and the founder of the startup was going to be on the other side of the country for a business trip. But, you know, Monday morning, I showed up in the office and he said, "Can you build some like ACL stuff? We need some access controls on this app we're building. See you later." And I spent the week digging into Django and hacking around and building ACLs. And he showed up like Friday afternoon, and I showed him what I was built. And, you know, we were both happy with each other from then on. So it was kind of a trial by fire, but it worked out.
But that's like the dream first week. No,
yeah, I was going to say, that's the perfect boss.
Go do some programming. We're not going to talk to you. Yeah.
In some ways, it was great. I mean, and it was the size of the startup was, I think, three engineers, including me and the founder. And so there was just a lot of heads down time just hacking on stuff. There was not a lot of overhead or difficulty organizationally. So that was great. It was very early on. I remember we had one problem with our homepage that it was doing a 9,009 queries to build the homepage or something. And the reason was that if you got a related object and then asked the related object for the parent, it would do a new query to get the parent, even though the parent is how you got to the object in the first place. And so I submitted a patch to Django that would just hold on to that object for later, so that we only needed 100 queries or something. Like, it was just one of those early on in the ORM. You know, there hadn't been that much optimization done, so there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. And so early days, you could dig into those kinds of things and make those kind of patches. The great thing about Django now, in some ways, is there isn't that low-hanging fruit because it's so mature. But in those days, there was still a lot of work that needed to be done to bring it up to speed.
Yeah, no select related or any of those, you know, conveniences for...
I don't even remember if select related was an option at the time.
Yeah, but, yeah. I mean, no class-based views either. You had to roll your own functions.
But listen, so from my point of view, class-based views are still sort of mysterious and new and confusing and almost a poster child for what's wrong with multiple inheritance. But
yeah, definitely.
We don't have to get into that. I'm sure if I...
No,
come on. No, this is a podcast on Django. Like, the whole point is...
So we're going to touch on this theme a bunch, I imagine, but I tend to start do a thing once and then keep doing that thing for a very long time and yeah. not consider new things. And the difference between function-based views and class-based views fits neatly into that narrative. I know how to write a function view as a view, and class-based views to me still seem weird.
Yeah. So you're but like, so you fire up a blank, you know, a blank py file, views.py, and you need to write a view, you're going to write a function-based view.
That's my go-to, yeah. And I mean, so since those early days of like spending a week writing access controls, I haven't done that much hardcore direct Django development. So in some ways, it's, you know, it's really moved on without me. And that's one of the challenges, you know, being a long-time adopter of technology can sometimes mean that you're an expert in the way that technology was 15 years ago, and you're stuck because you've just been spending your time doing something else rather than keeping up with all the amazing work that Django's been putting out. So, like, Will, I mean, Will async. Was, don't even talk to me about async.
Will was asking me earlier on about something. How do I organize a, I don't know, where do I put my settings files or something? And then I described a little file system layout to him, and he's like, "Ooh, old school." I'm like, "Yeah, probably."
Yeah, I know it's harsh. People call me old school now, but yeah, you were describing a running manage.py with --/ settings, and I said, you don't, because you used to, and you can still do it, but you used to have multiple settings files. You'd have like a base and local production test, and I would say these days you can use environment variables. So you have one file and then you swap in with the environment variables. But still works for Carlton. So, all the better.
But I still specify my settings on the command line because, like, who knows where they might be otherwise. Even if it's one file, it's still...
I think what saves me is I'm constantly teaching beginners. So I feel like I'm obligated to find out if there's a better way. Whereas for my own stuff, it's painful. It's like, what's the point? Like, I know what I want to build. I just want to build it. It's sort of like installing Python. If you like, everyone has a different way to do it. I do want to say though, like with running Boston Python, unusually, you get a lot of exposure to a wide spectrum. Because you have talks and there's project nights, you get total beginners. Yep. And then you get, postdocs at, science places. So, I want to just broadly ask you about that because you probably see more of a spectrum than I do, whereas most people are in their little lane with work, what's in front of them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so you mentioned teaching beginners. The great thing about teaching beginners is you don't have to bring them up to speed from the way things were in 2006, right? You can just pretend that the timeline starts now. Like now we do it like this and the old stuff doesn't matter, right? Carlton and I are burdened with all that luggage. So we will probably carry some of that around. And we may touch on another recent thing, which was me redoing my website, my personal website, as an actual Django project, which, full disclosure, I think I have 7 or 8 different settings files with different names of like base and that server name and et cetera, et cetera. And I know there's a better way to do it. But I also know that if I go and look for the better way to do it, I'm going to be presented, in classic Python style with a dozen different options hacked together by a dozen different people, each of whom thinks their way is the best. And it's hard to sort it all out and et cetera, et cetera. One of the nice things about Django is the out of the box, like Django will tell you how to do it kind of mentality, which is a rare island in the chaos of the Python world where we love the fact that people can hack together something and get it out there and people will start using it. But that makes for a lot of competition among all these solutions that can be really overwhelming for beginners, or not even beginners, but people for whom it's not their passion. Like, I don't want to make settings files. I want to make a website. So please just tell me how to make my settings files so I can get on with the thing I'm trying to do.
Right. But it's not JavaScript, right? I mean, because I feel that. But then whenever I...
It's not JavaScript.
I'm always like, wow, compared to JavaScript, Python is... gloriously.
The problem with JavaScript is that they don't, and I shouldn't talk trash about JavaScript, but my impression of the JavaScript world is that every time I dip in there, which is about once a year, there seems to be a new way to do things that is the right way to do things. So they haven't embraced the idea that there are many right ways to do things. They've sort of embraced the idea that there is always a right way to do things, but it's different every single year. And that's almost more difficult to keep up with, because now it's not just like, oh, I chose A and you chose B. It's I'm doing it right and you're doing it wrong because you're still doing it last year's way. That's the way it feels to me, at least. Maybe if I were more embedded in the JavaScript world, it wouldn't feel quite so foreign to me. But you asked me about Boston Python and the beginners, and it is true. Boston Python has a wide range of people attending. You mentioned talks and project nights. We've actually slowed down quite a bit during the lockdown. We haven't had a presentation night in a while. One of the interesting things about running a geographically based meetup during a pandemic is that everything becomes virtual, and then all sorts of people who live nowhere near you start showing up to your events. And that's okay, I guess. I'm not sure. Like, what's the word Boston mean in Boston Python if everything's on Zoom now? I don't know.
The San Francisco one, too, has had a number. I mean, I think that's the other large one that I'm aware of. And they've had a couple.
New York is very big, I guess, but not as active.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's...
Right. I think they put a lot of their energy into PyGotham, which is their annual, PyCon-like thing.
I think that's right.
So yeah, Boston Python, we do get a lot of beginners. It's interesting. We don't get that much discussion about from sort of Django beginners. We get a lot of Python beginners.
Yeah.
And a lot of data beginners.
Yeah, well, there is a...
And I'm not sure...
There is a Django
why
Boston
Django doesn't
group,
get as much. True.
Which isn't as large. But I mean, I agree. I tried to go to a number of the Boston Python ones and almost always saw you there, which is a good, I was like, man, I don't know if I should go all the time. And yet you found the time. But it's a lot of grad students or people getting a graduate degree in whatever and realize they want to, script something. And so Python. So yeah, not much of a web focus.
Exactly. Right. And the thing we've been doing in Boston Python during the lockdown, the new thing we've been doing is weekly office hours. So Mondays at noon, we just get on Zoom for an hour. And that's one of those things that we couldn't have done in person, because who's going to travel for an hour long thing at lunchtime? But it's easy to do weekly, and there's no prep for it. You just show up and it's like people just start talking about whatever, and maybe someone knows the answer or wants to talk about it, and you talk. So that's been very easy.
You all are saints to do that. I feel maybe it's just because I get a lot of emails from people, which I do respond to everyone eventually, but I feel like I couldn't do that. It would drive me nuts. Yeah. But I wish I could.
See that, on the flip side, I do get emails from people and I have every intention of replying to them, and then they're 6 months old and I just have to declare bankruptcy.
Well, it's important. Just because someone emails you doesn't mean you're obligated to respond.
Right. No, I know. But I want to, and then it didn't. I mean, that's the open source dilemma, right? You can't, no one is owed your attention, but you get into it because you want to give them attention. And how do you strike that balance and feel good about it and still make progress on the things you want to do and stuff like that? So,
I mean, that's a good question. Do you have wisdom on that? I mean, like, you're experienced open source contributor, what would you say?
I'd go back to Will's point, which is that you are not obligated. Like, it is very easy when you put a project out there. So as Will mentioned in the introduction, I'm the maintainer of coverage.py, which is the coverage measurement tool for Python.
6.0, congrats, by the way. That was yesterday.
6.0 came out. Yep. Yes. It was actually, well, there's a funny story about that. I was being kept awake in an Airbnb in Brooklyn by a next door neighbor who was having an electronic dance party until about 2 a.m.
See, that's why you can't leave Boston. You got to stay, shuts down at 9.
And while I couldn't go to sleep, I figured, well, I might as well shove out a release of coverage.py. I meant to do it to coincide with 3.10 anyway. And if I do it in the middle of the weekend, then maybe it won't crash too many Travis jobs the way major releases often do. So I did it. I did it then. So coverage.py, right? So it's a big project in the sense that lots of people use it because there really isn't any competition for coverage measurement in the Python world. Most people don't even realize that the standard library has a coverage measurement module in it called trace.py. They just come and get a third-party module called coverage.py, which I maintain. But as a result of that, there's a lot of issues that get written that I can't debug because they tend to be about esoteric execution environments. Like, oh, my TensorFlow something or other didn't get coverage measured. And I'm like, I only understood half of those words. And I don't have the time to go and figure that out. So it sits there. It's very easy to feel like, well, I put this out in the world, so I need to make it work. And if it doesn't work, then that's me being a bad person not fixing it. And you have to get past that feeling. You have to allow yourself to take time off or just turn away from it for a while. There are months where I'm just not interested to work on coverage.py, so I just don't. And occasionally it'll feel like, well, maybe I'm never going to get back to it, and maybe I'm just done with it. And then something comes up, and an interesting bug or a release, and I was like, oh, coverage.py, that's a cool thing. I'll do some stuff on it. And if it didn't come back, all right, then it wouldn't, maybe there'll be a whole year where it never comes back to me, and that'll be it. I don't know.
I see Carlton nodding. I mean, you two are both uniquely in this bucket. I mean, because Carlton, aside from Django, has a number of projects that he maintains over many years as well.
The big one is that I'm working to maintain at the moment is the channels project. And what you talked about, esoteric execution environments, it's exactly that. Someone will post a bug and it'll be like, you know, an Nginx config and a few lines of some logging file. And, you know, and it's like... I'm sorry, I don't even know where to begin to respond to this question. Right. And so I've been trying to click move to discussion for those. Because then it keeps the, which it's a new thing. And it's like, well, it's not like I just want to click close.
Right.
But I can't answer this. It's not really an issue. So maybe if I move it to discussion, it keeps the issues less
interesting.
Because one of the sort of demotivators for me is when the issues are piling up. And it's like, I feel a pressure. And it's like, oh, do you know what? I haven't got the emotional space to look at the repo. Whereas if I can move those issues over to discussions, those unaddressable ones over to discussions, then maybe someone else finds it searching. And they're like, oh, I had this problem and I did this. And that does happen. But then the issues can be like, oh, actually, there's an addressable, you know, code problem that's identifiable.
That's one thing I don't mind. So the coverage.py repo, I think, has 200 open issues right now, going back years. I'm okay with that. Whatever. Yeah. Some people say you should close them if you're not going to fix them. The author can close it. If they want to close it, they can close it. I think the signals are pretty clear in that repo. Your issue might not get looked at. One thing that has been great is that people maybe are getting better at making reproducible test cases. A few times. I've gotten a Docker image with the bug report. Like, here is the Docker image showing it happening. And I'm like, great. I can see it. Yeah. 'Cause, you know, too often you get people saying, look, you know, it failed like this. Can you give me a reproducible case? Well, here's a link to my Jenkins job that failed. How far in do I have to click before I can even maybe find the error message you're talking about? You know, if you can't put work into this, why am I putting work into this? So, if your listeners out there, when you write a bug, make it really, really reproducible. Write the instructions for that art school friend of yours who doesn't know how to use computers, and you are going to be doing the maintainer a huge favor.
But you do yourself a favor as well, because the maintainer will run it, and then they'll get to the breakpoint and they'll be like, oh, okay, I'll click you a few times. Oh, that's my code. Oh, why is that? You know, you've got a chance.
Yeah, and I understand. So the TensorFlow people, they don't know anything about how coverage works, right? And I don't know anything about how TensorFlow works. So we have to meet in the middle somehow. That's fine. I'm willing to dig into it. It's interesting to dig into it. There was a bug report about... Pony ORM, which is one of these tools that they take Python code. I think it's the Pony ORM. You write a query in Python code, and then they rewrite that Python code. And so when your query is running, it's not actually your code running. It's a rewritten version of your code running. So when you try to do coverage measurement, coverage doesn't think your code is running because your code isn't running. It's been moved over into a parallel universe, and that was very interesting to see. I think that was the
It's called ORM the smartest of. Python ORM.
Okay, I have a pull request against Pony ORM to make that a little bit clearer to people, and they haven't bothered to merge it yet, even though it's really simple. But there you go. Turnaround is fair play, I guess, right?
It's perhaps not reproducible.
You'll see.
Can I ask about? So you mentioned that Python has its own internal sort of coverage testing tool. Has there been any talk of, so we have this in the Django community where there's third-party packages, and Django is kept deliberately quite small. You know, you only pull in things when you really need to. Has there been any talk of pulling coverage into Python? I mean, I know the PSF has fellows and stuff. I mean, it's pretty much a standard tool for anyone I know who does Python professionally.
Yeah. There hasn't been. So there's two things you might have meant by that. One is pull it into the standard library, and the other is move it under the PSF organization.
I guess I meant GitHub. Both. Just as a question.
Right, either. Yeah, so there hasn't been any discussion of either of them. These days, I think Python is doing the right thing by being very reluctant to put things in the standard library under the theory that third-party packages can evolve more frequently and will keep the bloat down on the Python releases. And it's just better to have things decoupled than to have everything piled into the box. That, you know, we should all get better at installing and using third-party packages rather than hoping everything's going to go into the standard library. And the PSF thing, I think the moving... So the two projects that I know off the top of my head that are under the PSF organization on GitHub are Requests and Black. And I'm not quite sure. I don't know. That one always struck me as an odd thing. I'm not sure why the PSF, which doesn't even own the Python repo, why it would own third-party package repos. But
I don't know the story on Black. I mean, on Requests, it was because the maintainer was stepping away and there was some other stuff. So I think wanted to keep it going. I'm not sure about Black, but I know they have someone.
Black was started by Lukasz Lanka, right? So he's well in place there in the PSF and very involved. He's hardly walking away from it. So I don't know quite know what it means when something is under the PSF organization, right? Because it's not the PSF that's maintaining it.
Right. I suppose it just means maybe a fund. Well, yeah. We Django. Look to the PSF as sort of a big brother sister in terms of size on these things, because many of the same issues around organizing.
Yeah, stuff. And edX is going through a similar transition right now as well. So we often look to the PSF for how to do things. For instance, the PSF has PEPs, Python Enhancement Proposals. OpenEdX has OAPs, OpenEdX Proposals, I guess we call them. Not quite the same acronym. But so no, the moving coverage.py hasn't been suggested, and maybe that's just because I keep maintaining it enough.
Probably. I mean,
so everything's fine, I guess.
Right. It's not a squeaky wheel.
Right. I mean, it's interesting maintaining coverage.py because I get involved with new Python releases because coverage is intimately aware of how different Python releases run the trace function to indicate what lines got run and which didn't. And 3.10, there's two reasons why I coordinated the coverage 6 release with the 3.10 release. Mark Hammond was doing a lot of work in 3.10 to fix how the trace function traced things. There were lots of weird edge cases, and he was doing a lot of work to fix that. And when he fixed it, coverage.py would break because coverage.py was used to the old broken way that things were getting traced. And so I think I wrote, 10 different bug reports against Python 3.10 during its alpha phase saying, it looks like this now. Is this what you meant? And about half of them were, yes, it's what I meant. And about half of them were like, oh, no, that's not what I meant. And so we were kind of going back 50-50, does coverage have to change now or does Python have to change now? And we finally got that all straightened out, I think, by the time of at least beta 2, maybe even beta 1. So I was really happy to be able to push that out there. But the other thing that coverage.py had to do for 3.10 is that 3.10 now has the match case syntax for doing pattern matching. And that, it's a change in execution and ironically a change in syntax highlighting, which is something that coverage.py does along the way too. So there were a few, it was a very involved release to get coverage.py synced up with 3.10.
That's cool. The new syntax in 3.10 is quite cool. In Django, we don't get to use it for years because obviously we're still on 3.6.
Right, exactly.
Use the new match case for quite a long time yet.
I totally understand. There was a time when coverage.py would run on everything from Python 2.3 up to, 3.4 at the time or something like that. Coverage 6 is mostly called 6 because I dropped Python 2 support. So now I can use fstrings, for instance. So we're on 3.6 plus now as well.
I mean, what's your policy following the Python? Because Python 3.5 was end of last year, and 3.6 is going to be end of life this December, I think. And so what's your policy about dropping the support now with the new annual release cycle?
I tend to be very, very accommodating. I know some people are like, oh, Python 2's out of support on January 1st, 2020. I am pushing my new version that drops Python 2 on January 2nd. And I'm doing it, you know, for the good of everybody, because everybody should move up, and et cetera, et cetera. And my feeling is, look, I'm building this tool so that people can use it. And if keeping Python 2 support isn't a pain, then, you know, why not just keep it? Coverage 6, really what happened was that there was a different change in coverage that felt like it was going to need a major version bump because it changed the behavior. Coverage 5 and before would often accidentally measure third-party packages that you'd installed in your site packages. And in coverage 6, we made a change that was cleverer about where the code was coming from, and it would automatically exclude things that had been installed where third-party packages go. And that's great, but some people said, you know, actually that kind of broke my coverage and I have to go in and change my configuration. And so that felt like that should be a major version bump. And since I was doing a major version bump, and it's been 18 months since Python 2 went away, I figured I might as well, you know, let's clean this up now and drop Python 2.
Folks can still pin to the old version.
And they can pin to 5.5 if they want. That's always the consolation is, you know, you're not, by dropping support, you're not dropping anyone using your code because they can just keep using whatever code they were using.
I mean, super. So there was an article in the news this week in the, you know, the tech news about what was it? That coverage itself isn't a good marker of the test space. And what they dug into was that it's the number of tests that help. Like, you know, coverage is handy. And I remember asking you a question on Twitter about this a few months ago about, is there a way of sort of marking tests, of marking which tests are meant to cover what? Because I might have a few Selenium tests, which are kind of big end-to-end ones. And just by running those, I get, you know, I get quite a high coverage number. And
yeah, exactly.
Okay, so there's enough to riff on. I guess I'd ask, well, what's your thought on that and how coverage work, you know, and how you build a quality suite? And
yeah, and that is a tricky problem because, for instance, if you write one test and then run your project on coverage, you're probably going to get like 35% coverage just because all of your import statements will have run and all of your definition statements will have run and all of that gets measured. And it doesn't mean you're one-third tested yet. And by the way, depending on what you do in your asserts, you might literally not be testing. You might be running lots of code and not testing any of it, right? So I didn't exactly read. I think I saw that headline go by about the coverage problem. I didn't go and read the article. But your point is a good one, that you can write a test which exercises lots of code but can't actually assess the results of all that code. And if you had a way of marking a test saying that when I run this test, I don't want you to count the coverage or only count the coverage on this part of it.
Yeah.
And that there have been a few ideas about that in the coverage issue tracker, none of which we've implemented. The big, I keep saying we, but it's really just me.
you and your alternate personality.
Me, that's right.
Yeah.
I code up whatever my Rice Krispies tell me to. The big thing in coverage 5 was that the package can tell you for each line of code which tests ran
that's amazing.
To cover that line, which kind of gets at that same issue. Right, so you can take a look at the coverage report and you can see, oh, that line was actually only run by the integration test, for instance.
No, it was that coverage, that change in coverage 5 which prompted my question. Was it, could I somehow work this backwards such that I could say that I'm writing this test and it's for that function? And
right. And one of the things that keeps me interested in coverage is those new kinds of ideas. Like, that's a whole other interesting question. Like, what can I say about a test that could tell coverage to focus more accurately on what that test is doing? Like, some people will say, well, it should only measure the coverage of the immediate functions it calls, but it shouldn't measure the coverage of any function that those functions call. But that doesn't feel right. That's too crude a measure. And I don't know if anyone's going to want to put the work in to say, well, for this test, only measure the functions in that module, and then for that test, and you've got 1,000 tests, you're not going to go and decorate 1,000
every
tests.
Single one,
like,
yeah.
So what's the right balance there between the effort from the developer to say what they know and what they want about the coverage, and then how do you say that in a way that coverage can make use of? That's a very interesting thing to me. And that might be the next big thing, right? So coverage 5 had a lot of big changes. We switched to SQLite and we put in the context measurements so you could say which lines were measured by which tests. Coverage 6 had a lot to do with fixing the tracing with Python 3.10. What's next? I don't know. What's the big feature for coverage 7? Maybe it's something like that. But I want to make sure that it's something that people will actually get benefit out of. We can invent esoteric strange features, and if no one uses them, then what was the point? So
yeah,
it's good to be guided by the questions people ask in the issue tracker about doing these sorts of things.
So the flip side kind of question was that, so say I've got these nice unit tests which are targeted specifically just to their one function, and then I realize I need to refactor. And what I actually then need is an integration test around the sort of the outside. And I kind of need to napalm all those nice unit tests. I mean, what's your thought when you face a challenge like that? Like, how do you address that kind of issue?
It's a lot of work. Unit tests by their design are tied to what the units do. And so moving the units around is going to require moving the unit tests in some way, either, getting rid of half of them or writing 50% more of them or changing what they all expect. And it's a lot of work. And some people take the attitude like, I'm not going to bother with unit tests. What matters is whether the application works as a whole. And I'm just going to write a bunch of big integration tests. And what are the chances that a big problem will get through those? Maybe it's a good trade-off of benefit versus effort.
I remember seeing a line.
It's hard to know. And by the way, so I should say, though, for context, coverage can tell you which tests ran which lines of code, but you can also do things like run your integration tests and say, mark all of that coverage as integration, and run the unit tests separately and mark all of that coverage as unit. And then every line of code will either say integration or unit or both, right? So you can decide sort of how coarse you want it to be. The problem with marking every test on every line is if you've got 1,000 tests, then you're going to have lines that are covered by 200 tests. And there's no point getting a list of the names of 200 tests for a line. That's too much information. I went and looked at my own coverage's own coverage HTML reports, and they're a single file can have like a 2 megabyte HTML file result because every line's got dozens of test names annotated onto it, and it's not worth it.
So, I mean, a way of aggregating that information.
Yeah, right. Clump it up at a bigger level. That's not a level that coverage can intuit by itself, but it gives you the controls where you can indicate those things when you run the tests so that you get the information you want.
So just a thought that came up while you were talking about people arguing for integration tests. There's a line I saw, a few tests, mostly integration, something, I can't remember the exact line, but it was that kind of idea, is don't write too many tests, keep them mostly integration.
I think that's riffing on the food quote.
Yeah, the pollen. Right.
Eat less, mostly plants.
We'll swing over to edX in a minute, but like maintaining a big code base like that, like thinking about how you maintain your tests and manage testing and manage the evolution of the code, I think that's a really interesting thing, and I wanted to just pull out some of your thoughts on that. I mean, unless you say more though, please.
Well, I mean, to switch it over to edX, so it's a... edX is, Open edX, the code base, is a very large project. I mean, the edX organization on GitHub has 300 repos. There's probably at least 1.5 million lines of code. The main repo is called edX Platform, and it's a giant Django project. I think it's probably got about 400,000 lines of code right now, and a lot of tests. The tricky thing about me talking about the technology is that I've been mostly working on community issues at edX for a long time. So my hands on the bits of Django are pretty few and far between. But edX does struggle with the bulk of tests. We have pretty good coverage. So we've got really a pretty extensive test suite, and we're constantly rejiggering the sharding of tests across GitHub action suites so that we can keep the total wall time of running the tests to a reasonable limit. I think right now it's about half an hour to run them all. But it's and there's been cycles of, we have too many tests, these aren't telling us enough, let's just get rid of these. Which, to be perfectly honest, I felt a visceral shock at the idea of just delete tests. But the fact is that if they aren't telling you anything, and they do take a long time, and especially these in particular were the sort of front-end tests that tend to be kind of flaky, where not only are they not giving you any value, but they're taking up your time by with false alarms. So that was the right thing to do, is to delete those tests. And it's hard to strike the right balance because, you know, developers, maybe like many people, but especially developers, tend to be very susceptible to gamification. You know, oh, there's a metric there. There's a needle that moves that way. I want to move it all the way that way. And so, and you know, I'm one of the main purveyors of one of those needles, right? Coverage measurement. What's your percentage? You're not at 100% yet. You know, you got to get to 100%. And that's a lot of work that may not provide much benefit. So trying to strike a balance rather than just being the best or the last or the first or whatever is really hard.
Oh, I don't know if, hopefully your team is as familiar with this, but Adam Johnson, who's on the Django security team, among other things, has a whole book called Speed Up Your Django Tests, which is, they should look at it if they're not. Uh-huh. It's very well suited to a large organization. And just, I mean, Carlton, we both read it. It's just so many things that if you're on a big code base, it's like, oh yeah, that helps. Like,
He's got a chapter on profiling that's worth it just for the chapter on profiling. It's just amazing.
I'll have to take a look at that and make sure people know.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes.
One of our challenges at edX is that we use something like 150 different third-party packages to build upon. And we try to stay on the latest, you know, we try to stay on supported Django releases. We're in the middle right now of moving to Django 3.2 from 2.2. But it's hard to move. I mean, and aside from the question of what do we have to do to our code to make it work on Django 3.2, we have to go and look at 150 third-party packages and see, are they running on 3.2? And many of them are not, because these packages, you know, they get stale. And then we have to decide, can we get rid of that package? Can we live with it the way it is? Do we have to fork that package? And actually, one of our engineering leads here at edX, the name is Jeremy Bowman. He's doing a whole talk at the upcoming DjangoCon about how we manage that and how we're trying to actually be proactive in the community to push out what we've learned about other people's packages and getting them onto Django 3.2 so that we can get onto Django 3.2. So he's doing some interesting work, pushing the envelope forward on how an entire community, not just a large million line project, can move to Django 3.2, but how an entire community of third-party packages can move forward onto Django 3.2.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because you're maintaining a, you know, so I've just recently bumped AppConf, which I know edX depends on too. The only bump was to add the Trove classifiers for 3.2 and 4.0.
Exactly.
Like, right. But it's still like, you know, do it, clean up the last few issues, make sure, you know, update the packet. It's still, you know, it's a session to do and it needs doing. And okay, for AppConf, it's once every, you know, couple of years, do a release, it's fine. But you know, if your package needs actual updates, then it's all the more.
Right. And for us, it's hard to look at a third-party package and decide, oh, is this just a missing metadata, or is it actually not going to work on 3.2?
A question I did want to ask you, Ned, about with testing. I mean, I think we're all engineers. We all value it. Managers don't always. You've worked in a lot of organizations. What is your advice for an engineer who is trying to sell taking the time to testing to a manager who may or may not be technical and may not see the value in it?
That's a good question. So to go back to that job I started on Django, with the ideal job where the boss left for a week, that was the same boss who said that the way we're going to test our code is we're going to push it to production and people are going to tweet at us. Maybe it wasn't
tweeting
at the
time.
We're doing it live. And actually, that Bill O'Reilly clip of doing it live was popular meme around the office. Absolutely. So one thing that happened there was that they were talking about, you know, we're going to ship in a month. And I was looking at the software and I thought, this is not going to be ready in a month. But how do I convince them of that? Mm-hmm. And what I did is I said, we should do some usability testing. And I got some friends to come in and be the subjects in the usability tests. And I ran the usability tests, and I didn't know much about running usability tests, but you know, I knew enough to sort of pull the wool over those guys' eyes on the usability test. And you know, I said, look, this guy's sitting down to use the app you said we're going to ship in a month. Are we ready? And they're like, okay, I can see it. We're not ready. So if the manager is not convinced that testing is worthwhile, keep an eye on the production outages and try to convince them to do a root cause analysis and have the analysis come up with what is probably the answer, which is if we'd known that, you know, X and Y and Z earlier, we could have prevented this. The edX engineering culture is great that way. We do RCAs all the time, and it's a blameless culture. And I don't know if I've ever heard someone say, you know, let's just build the feature and get it out there, and then we can write the tests later. You know, we just have to get the feature done in time. You know, those sorts of ill-advised trade-offs that you can sometimes hear pointy-haired bosses making.
Right. And that just rots the morale of the engineers too. I mean, because I came into technology through the business end, and I sometimes talk to MBAs who go and be product managers, and I try to tell them the story of, well, when you go and manage a team of engineers and you're not an engineer, it's very easy. There's a new product that your boss says, you know, get it done in 2 weeks. Your engineers say it'll take 4 weeks, and you crack the whip and find a way to motivate them to get it done in 2 weeks. And you think, wow, I just got to crack the whip on these lazy engineers. And the engineers think, well, this person doesn't know anything, doesn't value testing, the code smells, the tech debt accumulates. And so both sides lose, even though the manager thinks they win.
Right.
And so, you know, having things like, my advice is generally like, because the issue is you want to, when you're in charge of managing the team, like that's the onus is on you. You want to have an output or an outlet for that. So I would often recommend saying you need to have like a bug day every month, every couple of weeks, so that the engineers have to prioritize it, because every bug is important to an engineer. But like, how do you, when you're not technical, figure out which bug really matters? You say, okay, I'm, you know, moving heaven and earth to give you the time, and we'll celebrate it and get a gong or something, but you need to prioritize the bugs. And then you're not just saying no all the time. You're saying, okay, yes, at this date, and then we'll, and that sort of doesn't solve the problem, but that helps morale a lot. And it can also sometimes be effective versus, you know, every bug that comes up, is it important? Time off and we'll help you with that.
Right. Yeah. And giving the engineers some measure of autonomy over, you know, some part of their effort is a really good thing to do. And by the way, the startup that I'm talking about, he was not a pointy haired boss. I like to think of it as sort of a healthy debate over the costs and benefits of alternate approaches. And we shipped a good product, I think. Like I said, we got acquired by Hewlett Packard. It's not around anymore, but
yeah. Well, it's like 100% test coverage, right? I mean, it's a goal. There's the truth is it's somewhere south of that, but question is where.
Exactly. Yeah. By the way, when we got hired by Hewlett Packard, they looked at us and they said, "Oh, this Django Python thing. How quickly can you port it to Java?" Luckily, those people went away, and we never heard from them again. But there was way more craziness after the acquisition by Hewlett Packard than before.
Yes, I think that's something that from the outside, perhaps it seems that large corporations are more stable on the individual level, and most of my experience is it's the opposite. So we're coming a little bit up on time. Are there any topics that we haven't asked you about, or things you want to mention while you're talking to the Django community?
The Django coverage plugin is a thing. It's interesting. So the cool thing about Django is it's got these templates, and templates aren't meant to have logic in them, but they can have a little bit of logic in them. You've got if statements and loops and things. And there's a plugin called the Django coverage plugin that will tell you which aspects, which parts, which lines, I guess, of your templates have been used in your tests and which have not. And that's it's an interesting project in and of itself, because when I first wrote it, I took the strategy of I don't need to stick to public interfaces. I can use whatever I want that I find inside Django, and that's fine because it's on me and I'm taking responsibility for that. And one of the problems with the 6.0 release of coverage is that I heard from at least two different people who said 6.0 broke my thing. And I looked at it and like, yeah, your thing was using private stuff that I didn't tell you to use. It's not my fault. I don't have to do anything about that.
You're welcome. But you just say, you're welcome. It was free.
You're welcome. That's right. On the flip side, Django Coverage plugin does use internal stuff from Django. But like I said, I knew going in that's what I was doing. And when it doesn't work anymore because Django has shifted, I update Django Coverage plugin to do a different thing. And I have a testing strategy where every week on Sunday, it runs with the latest tip of Django. And if it breaks, I will hear about it and I can update it quickly before it becomes a problem. Ironically, that test run this week only told me about how Coverage 6 broke it and not how Django had broken it. But, you know, that's what tests are for, to tell you this stuff broke. The universe changed and your stuff doesn't work anymore. So,
well, the template engine doesn't change very often, but there's a bit of work going on at the moment to optimize, you know, various bits, you know, make it a bit more performant. And so maybe you'll have some work.
I understand that. You might be surprised to hear that inside coverage.py is its own template engine, partly because it was just fun to write, and partly because I didn't want to have any third-party dependencies in coverage.py, but I wanted to make nice HTML pages.
Yeah. Great. Well, we'll definitely link to that. Anything else?
Well, I don't know if we're going to talk about it much, but I wanted to talk to you about Cog, which is one of your other little projects, which you claimed at the beginning your other projects aren't as interesting, but Cog is an amazing little code generator. So
quickly, Cog started when I was working at a startup that was doing mostly C++ code, and we had the need to have a SQL schema and Python and C++ code that matched. And I wanted a way to generate the two from something. And the something was going to be Python. And I tried using Cheetah, if you remember that templating engine, but that was for text and not for code. So it was difficult. And so instead I came up with this thing called Cog, which is basically a way to have a text file in which you could embed bits of Python and it would run through the text file and execute the Python. And whatever the Python generated would replace the Python in the output. And it worked great for that, for making C++ and SQL. And I actually use it to make my PyCon talks. So I author my PyCon talks in a giant HTML file using a JavaScript-based slide package. And there's bits of Python in the presentation that generate parts of the slide. So when I want, you know, a diagram or a table that's easier to generate with code than by hand, I put in the Python code and it generates that stuff. So it lives on in kind of a much different environment. And it's one of those packages that I hardly ever do anything with, but about once a year I hear from someone who's using it for something or wants to make a change. And so it's got kind of this tiny but dedicated following. So yeah, I guess I had forgotten about Cog. That may be my second most successful side project.
It's just super. Like, I don't know. I've used it for generating like JavaScript clients from, you know. Nope.
Okay, there you go. That's similar to its original purpose in life.
Yeah, and it's like this is, you know, whenever I find myself writing like really boilerplate, so I'm just repeating myself here.
Yeah, exactly.
Then, you know, reach for like Cog's just an awesome little tool. So I wanted to thank you for that.
Sure.
I think that's like levels. Like they say that, you know, developers want to do a blog, so you end up building your own static site generator. And this is like you doing that for talks. So I respect that.
Exactly. Exactly. Oh, I'm constantly on sides of sides projects to make nicer looking diagrams in my blog posts on my Django hosted self-written Django side project site, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. No, but that's great. Endless. That's what you know, because from that comes coverage.py and who knows what else, right? If you lose that sense of play.
That's right. Yes, it's very helpful to have a side project where either you can do it exactly right because you can't in your day job, or because your day job makes you do it exactly right and your side project, you can do it wrong. Like just having that outlet.
Testing
for whichever
is optional.
Thing you're frustrated. That's right. Testing,
branches,
I don't need that.
Branches, everything is master. Like, let's go.
Yeah, exactly. Screw it.
That's like my site. Like, branches. My personal site.
You mentioned the personal site here because we we let you slip this by in it, but you're rewriting that, and what was the old? You're rewriting that as a straight Dango site now, right?
Well, so it's more complicated than that. So my personal site started in 2002 as a bunch of Python code that generated HTML that I would FTP up to.
So you did have a static site generator.
It was originally, yes.
But this is pre-pip freeze, right? Was it Flask? A Flask freeze, I think, right? There's a Flask freeze way you could do it.
It wasn't, there wasn't a web. I forget what it was originally.
I guess you're way before that, so yeah.
It was all XSLT. Yeah. Okay, but don't laugh because it's still all XSLT. But
yeah, that's what I wanted to ask because it's still the same thing.
It's still XSLT. So it started as just like, let's use XSLT and generate a pile of HTML and FTP it up there. And then at some point I switched it to being a Django site that I would use a static site generator with locally to generate a pile of HTML that I would FTP up to the site. And to do comments, it had PHP code in there too. And there was some interesting Django middleware that would execute PHP along the way for local testing or something like that. Yeah, it got really wacky. And then this summer, my hosting provider said, we're kicking you off. They were getting bought and they said they could transfer my site. And then they said they couldn't transfer my site. So you got to find a new host. And so I went looking so I thought, fine, I'll just do a real Django site. I made one little stop on, maybe I can just move the site as it is to a new host, but the old site was PHP 5 and the new host was PHP 7. And I definitely didn't want to invest any time in understanding how to upgrade PHP. So I bit the bullet and I made it a real Django site that's really hosted on Dreamhost. I had to re-implement the whole comment system, which was cool. And now I can do better things with the comments and et cetera, et cetera. So, but it's still very wacky. So I still generate I import a lot of XML files into a SQLite database. The SQLite databases are synced up to the server where the Django site will use XSLT to convert the XML into HTML and serve it. So all sorts of wrong decisions, but it works.
But yet, like 10 years of, you know, just bolting on a new bit. Yeah,
well, yeah, 20 years. It'll 20, be 20 years in spring. But now I can do cool things. Like if I have images, I can auto-convert them to WebP and serve them as WebP from then on. So the first hit does the convert, and then everyone else gets a better image, and I could just do JPEGs locally. So, cool stuff.
Love it. Maybe it's the last question to take us out. So edX, I think this is public, has just been, so a nonprofit that's been acquired by a for-profit company. I'm just curious what you can say about that, and how do you envision that changing your role, right, if at all?
Yeah, so this is a huge topic. But I mean, honestly, I know what's public.
Yeah.
Not much more than that. So my role at edX has been sort of the face of Open edX within edX. And then outside of edX, my role has been sort of the face of Open edX from edX. So I think of myself sometimes, some people think that I'm like the big brains behind Open edX or something. I've called myself the sidelines mascot for OpenEdX. Like, I'm the guy in the suit dancing around as hard as I can to get everyone excited. So when the announcement was made that 2U, an ed tech company, was going to acquire at edX, I think that was at the end of June, people were getting in touch with me like, did you organize this? And I was like, I found out about it when you found out about it. You know, when the news went public, that's when I knew.
Yeah, sometimes you're last to know when you're on the inside.
Yeah, exactly. So 2U is acquiring edX, but edX is a nonprofit, and a for-profit company cannot acquire a nonprofit company, or at least, I don't know the legality, but what's actually happening is that there is going to be a new nonprofit formed, which will get all of the proceeds from the sale, because you can't create a nonprofit to further education and then sell it to a profit company and then me keep the money. Like, I don't get any of the proceeds of the acquisition because it was a nonprofit, right? The money that went into the nonprofit has to continue the goal of the nonprofit. So there's going to be a new nonprofit who continues that goal of education, furthering education. And most of that X is going to go to you. There will be people who work for the new nonprofit. We don't know who those people are. We don't know who's going to run the nonprofit. We don't even know exactly when this is all going to happen. It's you know, under legal review by, I guess, the Attorney General of Massachusetts. But it's going to be an interesting time. So one of the challenges of edX and OpenEdX is that, I mean, and this is a classic problem with any Django project, is that you set out to build a platform, but mostly what you're building is an application, right? So like when, like Django apps, oh, I'm going to have a blog app in my project. And your blog app is never really just a blog app, right? I mean, it's not general enough to be used by other people. It's always got connections to the rest of the project, and you hard-coded the name of it in there because it was just too much trouble to make it a setting the right way, and you don't know what the API should be
about.
To a blog engine.
Okay.
This is just me. So, OpenEdX is no different, right? So way back in 2012, you know, edX was building a site to serve education, and it was a Django site. And the goal was always to open source it so other people could use it. But, you know, mostly it was just edX that we offered to other people to use. And over time, we've gotten better about making it more of a platform and more generalizable. But all along the way, we were deploying from master. And we deploy multiple times a day from master today to edX.org. And that's, you know, the business that pays my salary. So it's very important that we keep it running. Meanwhile, we also want to get contributions from people into that open source repo, but how do we manage that risk, right? They're not running a site that has 30 million, 40 million, I don't know the exact count now, 50 million learners right now. So they're not dealing with the kinds of scale we're dealing with. They don't know what our roadmap is. So up until now, the contribution process has been very tightly controlled by edX. Every change has to be reviewed by edX, roughly. We're opening it up a bit now, but for the most part. Now that there's going to be a separate nonprofit that's going to own OpenEdX, separate from the edX company that's running the edX.org website, what's the new contribution model going to be? What's the flow going to be? How do we keep code moving at high velocity and keep the business stable under two separate legal entities, one of whom is going to want, for the most part, to increase contribution, and one of whom, for the most part, is going to want to keep the business stable? So that's a whole new open source dynamic that we're going to have to navigate.
I mean,
it's a very interesting time.
It was when your colleagues came on, you know, a year or so ago and talked through the OpenEdX. I went and checked it out and downloaded and tried to get up and running, but it wasn't easy to get up and running I know my way around Django, but it was like, right. Oh, hang on, this is tricky.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. And, you know, like I said, for the most part, edX engineers are focused on how can we make edX.org a little bit better today, not how can we make it easier for someone else to run another site that also does education. Like, no one's opposed to that goal. It's just probably the fourth or fifth goal in their list, and they're not being measured on that goal. So it's very easy for it to lag.
I think that's, I've heard that something of a similar dynamic is even the case with, say, React, which is us, you know, within Facebook, but it's the engineers there want to do that. And Facebook itself sort of does it to humor them, but doesn't really care. And so from the outside, it's like, well, Google or Facebook or Microsoft supports this open source package. And really, it's probably a handful of people on the inside fighting, you know, they're getting paid by those companies, but, you know, their boss isn't saying nice job on React release.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, when you're done with everything else, you can maybe do that if it helps us hire people.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're constantly, I mean, for 8 years now, we've been trying to find good projects that we can compare ourselves to. In other words, you know, the problems we have, are there other projects that have those problems? How are they solving them? Can we use those solutions too? And there's always differences between the projects that make it not quite a direct map, and so it's hard to find analogs. But actually, that the example of React coming out of Facebook actually was a recent one that we discussed. I don't know how we'd actually get to the bottom of that. Like, how do we get into the cubicles at Facebook to see what their actual, you know, goals and measurements are, and how do they support it? Maybe we should just go ask. I don't know. I don't know. But it's fascinating to one of the. I mean, it's one of the tricks of open source is that it's not. there's no one way to do it. And there's sort of the classic way, you know, just do it like Red Hat does it. Well, Red Hat doesn't deploy to master multiple times a day. We'll just do it like WordPress does it. Well, that's a little different. So, you know, it's interesting to work in open source and have to sort of rethink it from first principles to make it work for everyone, right? edX loves open source as a way of expanding our engineering capacity, right? Instead of having, I don't know what it is, 100, 150 engineers at edX, we could have 800 engineers among all of the people using OpenEdX. But we only get those 800 engineers if we can coordinate their contributions in a way and open up the channels so that the contributions can flow. And that means we have to tell those 800 engineers how to get started, like Carlton said. We have to tell them, well, what are we interested in? Where are we headed? What's the roadmap? And, you know, edX works like most companies. It's, you know, they're the edX employees and we all talk to each other. But how do we talk beyond ourselves so that we can get those 800 people? That's the big challenge. And we're entering a whole new phase of that with this split of the acquisition and the new nonprofit.
I mean, it's a really good example. If you want, you know, someone was asking on Twitter just today about, you know, what are examples of big Django sites? Well, OpenEdX platform is a really good repo. There's a lot going on there. There's a, you know.
The problem with people want those examples because they want to know how to do it well. And it's easy to find large projects. And it's easy to find good projects. Finding good large projects is really hard because the large projects have been around for a long time. And so they've just acquired lots of, first they've got the archaeological layers of how best to do it, right? So way down at the bottom, you've got the function views, and then maybe we've got some class-based views, and the settings files, like we said, have been through their evolution. But they've also just accumulated the tech debt and the cruft from having, you know, 100 people work on it for 8 years, and it's just hard to keep everything with one voice and best practices spread across a million lines of code. And
But isn't that what being an expert in coding feels like, is that you still feel the same? It's just that people ask you and you realize there's no solution, so you just have to pick one as a expert. That's how I feel. Like when people ask me something, like, I don't know, but then I ask around and, you know, Carlton doesn't know, Jeff doesn't know, a couple other people, Adam doesn't know. It's like, it's unknowable or there's no best practice because I just checked.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and sometimes we've got a joke among architects at edX that the answer, it's always the same answer. The answer is, it depends.
That's the tagline for our podcast. We haven't said it yet. We try really hard not to slip it in.
Right. But even like beginners come in saying, well, what's the best way for me to install Python and get it ready for my project? Well, it depends. Are you doing scientific work? Conda. Are you comfortable with the command line? Well, you might like virtual env wrapper. But otherwise, why don't you just go into PyCharm and pick new project? You know, it depends. Things are complicated.
Right. And that's the kind of thing that a newcomer, they just want it to work.
Right. And that's not just because they're a newcomer. It's because it's the part of the thing they're not interested in, right? I'm not a newcomer, and I would love to not have to think about virtual env wrapper and just have it be solved for me. It seems like about once every 6 months, I have to revisit how I get Python installed on my computer and how I get virtual env in those versions of Python and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. As we wrap up, I think Python has gotten better in that, you know, A, just use Docker. B, if you just need one version, you can just go grab the official installer. That works fine. And then if you need multiple versions, like a regular person, you can use PyEnv and, you know, I guess Poetry if you want to get fancy. But that third case, hopefully it's not your first time installing Python if you need to have multiple versions to work on stuff.
Yeah, but you just described the better way, and I think you had three conditionals along that path.
Well, it depends. Yeah, it depends on what they need.
It depends.
I mean, I think
it depends.
And the answer, I mean, so I've been thinking about this for my Django books because I have a section on, you know, how do you get to Django? It's like, well, I got to slog through Python, and I have switched away from Homebrew on Mac, and just the Python.org installer actually I think works quite well. And, you know, yeah, there's all these things it doesn't do, like how do you switch Python versions? It's like, well, there's a whole universe of thought on that, but
we're
doing clean greenfield stuff, and so it's, you know, Django 3.2 and Python 3.3.10 soon, and don't have to worry about it.
Yep.
Anyways, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. I know we've gone a little over, but I appreciate, we had a lot of questions around testing and edX, and again, you were one of the very first people we wanted to have on this podcast, so I appreciate you taking the time.
Super.
So now the whole podcast is done. You can just this is the series finale.
Yeah, no, it's like coverage six, you know, we'll take 18 months off and
good. Now this was a lot of fun. I always enjoy doing these, and it's great to have a chance to have a longer discussion. I know we tweeted each other and maybe even see each other in IRC or Discord sometimes, but having an actual discussion with paragraphs and replies and thoughtfulness is great.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, I sort
thank
of
you for coming on
the
there.
Goal is to lose people. Like, I have passive people who are like, oh, coding, you have a podcast. Like, let's go listen. And they get five, you know, PhDs and something else. You get 5 minutes in, they're like, you lost me. I was like, good, because right. I'm not good. Trying to appease right. you.
That's right. You're not the audience.
Yeah.
That's right.
If you are interested in the podcast, djangochat.com, chat Django on Twitter, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.